Hi, everybody. Today we're going to talk about sorting. Just a few announcements. Homeworks 3 and 4 are graded. You should be able to see them on Sakai under assignments. If you have any questions, let me know. And I'll direct you to the TA who graded. So homework 5 is due a week from today. If you guys have any questions about it, you can ask now or on Wednesday or email. But I just want to give you a chance to ask questions if you had any. No questions. All right, now I'm going to ask a few questions myself. So, this is about methods of solving problems on sorted versus unsorted lists. Question is, all of these problems, except for one, can be solved faster on a sorted list than on an unsorted list. Which one is the one that it doesn't matter if the list is sorted or unsorted? And the problems are A, what's the smallest element, which is the min? B, what's the average? C, what's the most common element, which is the mode, also called? D, what's the median? E, what's the closest element to 100? Stopping at 1:30. Five more seconds. Stopping. All right, that's very nice. Okay, let's try this one. This one is about graphs and kind of the definitions, different definitions that we learned last time. The question is, which of the following statements is true of the graph in the picture? And the statements are A is a source, B, A is a sink, C, A, B, C, A is a cycle, D, B is reachable from A, and E, they are all true. Stopping in 10 seconds. Well, let's make it 10 after 1. 10 seconds after 1. Stopping. All right. Majority was right. Any questions about this one or the previous one? No. All right. We can move on. So last time we talked about graphs, and the reason we talked about graphs was because we talked a little bit about how Google works, and we said that the internet can be represented as a huge graph. And when Google is trying to find methods to fast searches, it uses that kind of representation. But we also said that we showed how we can get an unsorted list and a sorted list, and how much difference sorting makes. And so this is one of the biggest problems in computer science. Google, there's a lot of research at Google about it, probably. It's very important. It makes things very fast, and we're going to actually see how much faster, how big of a difference it makes. And the main point is that there's a lot of ways of doing it. There's a lot of methods of doing it. And we're going to look at a few methods of sorting today. So this is something we closed last time. We said that, okay, the way Google works is it crawls the internet, it goes from link to link. Let's say it finds a new page, and then there's a lot of words on that page. And what we said that the way it works is that for each word in the world, it has a list of all the web pages that contain that word. So that when you type in that word, it can do a fast, it can give you results fast. So the question is, you're finding a new web page. Google is finding a new web page. How does it find the words on the web page? How does it skim that web page very, very fast? So this is just the unsorted list of words. I showed a picture of our class's website with all the links. And you see the list is, there's a number, which is the page, web page number. And then there's all the words on that web page. So this is sorted according to the web page. But that doesn't help us very much. So if we were to find something in here, it would be very hard to find. What we can do is basically anything we would want to do with that list of words takes, in the worst case, we have to go through all of the words in the list. We have to do, if there's n words, it's a big O of n. We have to touch every word. If we wanted to organize the data to simplify it, we can just remove words that show up multiple times and sort them. And so now, if I give you a word, if I say find the word public, it's going to be very easy for you guys to find that word because you just know that public is in the second half of the alphabet, so you can look in the second half of the columns, and it's pretty easy to find, way easier than before. So sorting... Sorting helps in this case. This is another example of a list that is the top of the page is the list that's unsorted. The bottom of the page is the list that's sorted. A lot of questions can be answered tons faster on the list on the bottom, on the sorted list, than on the list on the top. So let's try to do another question. So the question is in an unsorted list, if the list is unsorted, how many numbers do we need to look at to find the max in the list? So you're given the list before, and how many numbers do you have to look at? How many numbers do you work with? Options are A, it's big O of log n, B, it's big O of n, C, it's big O of n log n, D, it's big O of n squared, E, it's a constant. Yeah?
Would this be in the worst case?
In the worst case, yes. Stop at one. 5 more seconds. Stopping. Okay, very good. Majority got it right. So why is that? Why is it big O of n in the worst case? Can somebody explain why? Right, because that's how many operations you do. Because you don't know where the max is going to be. Like, it's not like there's a spot where you know where the max is going to be. You have to look at all the numbers. Okay, good. What about the on a sorted list? How many numbers do you need to look at to find the max? And the options, you have the same options.
I
I'll stop in 10 seconds. Stopping. Okay. It's a little more spread out, but the majority is right. So can somebody explain why it's a constant number of numbers that we need to look at if the list is sorted? Yeah.
If the list is sorted, then the largest number, the max number, will be the last number in the series. So you would simply have to look at the quantity.
Yes, exactly. So if the list is sorted, no matter how big the list is, it can be a million numbers, you only have to look at the last number. So that's a constant amount. It's actually, the constant is one, right? You only have to look at one number. All right. So let's say that to see a little bit of the difference, let's take an extreme case. Let's say you take the phone book of a big city like New York City, right? Imagine that. And imagine that you're looking for a person. It's pretty fast to look for a person according to their last name, right? You know that they're alphabetically sorted. What if I ask you, okay, find me a person whose first name is this. Like, let's say it's a rare name, right? It would be, in the worst case, you have to look at every single person in the phone book, which, you know, is millions of people. So that's, it would make a huge difference. A lot of lists in that, you know, Google has to deal with, that real life applications have to deal with, are very big. Let's see if we have the problem of a pair of numbers summing up to a certain number. So let's say that we're asking the question, is there a pair in this list? A pair of numbers that sum up to 1,054. How do we do it differently in the unsorted list than in the sorted list? Where in the unsorted list, what we need to do is take the first number, and then we have to look at every single number in the list to see if it pairs up, if the two numbers sum up to 1,054, right? So we take the first number, we have to look through the whole list. How many numbers do we have to look at? How many? Let's say the list is n numbers. N minus one, right? You have to look at n minus one number to find a pair for the first number. What about the second number? How many numbers? N minus 2. What about the third one? N minus 3. What about the last pair? Like the second to last number, how many numbers do I have to look at? 1, right? Okay, so this is also, if I reverse the whole thing, it's 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus n. For the sorted list, the way I can do it is I can take advantage of the fact that it's sorted. So what I can do is I can start with the first number, and I can also look at the last number at the same time. And I can ask the question, do they add up to 1,054? Well, if you add them up, they give you 1,101, which is bigger than 1,054. So now I want to find a pair for 124. I just have to move the last number to the second to last number. What about 124 with 947? That's still too big. So I can move on to the next one. That's 1,042. So now it's too small. So I definitely know that 124 does not have a pair. And there's no number that sums up to, added to 124, sums up to 1,054. Right? I didn't look at all the numbers in the list. I only looked at three numbers so far. Right? So now I can move on to 126, and I don't have to move the last number either. So 126 and 918 gives me 1,044, which is also too small. So for 126, I figured out that there's no pair. And I only had to look at one number. I move on to 147, added up to 918, that's 1065. I move on to 907, that's 1054. and so I found a pair. So I only had to look at how many numbers? 7 numbers, right? In the worst case, how many numbers do I have to look at if I use this method? If the list is n numbers? Well, let me ask a different question. In this case, for the unsorted list, I have to look at some numbers twice, right? I take the first number, I look at every single number in the list. I take the second number, I look at every single number in the list. There are numbers that I look at more than once, right? Do I look at any numbers more than once in the second method? Each number I look at only once because I advance with the numbers, the smaller numbers, and I advance with the bigger numbers at the same time. So I don't have to touch one number twice. So that means, let's see, how many numbers do I have to touch? How many numbers do I have to look at for this this algorithm? What is 1 plus 2 plus da 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 plus n minus 1? A big O. Can somebody tell me the exact how much this is? What's this 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus da da plus n minus 1? How much is that? As a function of n. What's that? N times n minus 1 over 2. Okay, good. So that's n squared over 2 minus n over 2. So what's the big O of that?
Big O of n squared.
So if my list is unsorted, I need a big O of n squared algorithm. My method is big O of n squared. What about for the second one? If the list is sorted, what's the big O of? How many numbers do I have to look at? I look at each number once, right? I only go through the list one time. So that's a big O of n. Right? I don't look at, there's no number in the list that I have to look at twice or more. So this makes a huge difference. It's if you take n to be big, it makes a difference. So if n is 1,000, it's the difference between 1,000 and 1,000,000, right? Which is pretty big. Okay, so we saw a few examples of how sorting definitely helps. So we have to figure out now how to do it. If sorting helps so much, if it makes it so much faster, how do we sort? How do we sort a list of numbers? And there's a lot of methods, as I mentioned before. One method is selection sort, which is very easy. You just go through the list, and at each step, you choose the smallest number in the list. And you say, that's going to be the minimum. So you know that that's going to be the first element in the sorted list. You go through the list again, you choose the next smallest element. That's going to be your second number in the sorted list, and so on. And so here's how it works. Here's an example. Let's say you have the list 692584. You always look at the smallest. What's the smallest element in the list? And what's the smallest in this case? 2. And so you take it and you set it aside. You put it in the sorted list. And that's going to be your first element. What's the next smallest element? That's 4, right? So you're going to put it as the second element in the sorted list. What's the next smallest? 5, right? Then 6, then 8, and then 9, and you're done. So that's how it works. And it's called selection sort because you always select the smallest element you've seen so far. This is the code for the scratch code for it. It basically says this part here is just to, if you've already had stuff in the sorted list, you delete everything, you clear your sorted list. Remember, the sorted list starts by being an empty list. And then you do for the whole deck of cards, let's say you're sorting cards, you find the smallest element, and you insert the smallest element as the last element in the sorted list. So you just take the smallest element in the deck, you put it in your sorted list as the last element. And you delete the smallest element in the deck. And the smallest element, I'm sure you could all write this code, or most of you. You just go through the whole list, and you remember your smallest element so far. If you run into something that's bigger, that's smaller, you replace the smallest element. So at the end, you have the index of the smallest element in the list. And this is taking about 2.5 minutes to sort 100 elements. If you were to write this in Scratch, and I'm going to make Scratch code available, that's how long it would take to run. So how many comparisons does selection sort do? So when you choose your smallest element in the beginning, let's say you have n elements, how many numbers do you have to look at to find the smallest elements? How many numbers do you have to touch to find the min in an unsorted list? N, right? Then you get rid of it, right? You delete it, and you're working with n minus 1 elements, right? How much time does it take to find the smallest element in an n minus 1 unsorted list? So you have an n minus 1 elements. How long does it take to, or how many numbers do you have to look at to find them in? N minus 1. Then your list is n minus 2. How many numbers to find them in? So you have to look at all of them, right? N minus 2. Then you have 2 elements left, and then you have 1 element. So this is how many comparisons you have to do. This is how many numbers you have to look at. What is this giga of? Giga of n squared, right? This is again 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus da 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 plus da 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 plus n. And this is actually n times n plus 1 over 2. N squared over 2 plus n over 2. So selection sort is a big O of n squared kind of algorithm. What if the list was sorted? How long would it take? So you have a list of n elements. They're all sorted. How long does selection sort take? So imagine that this is your list of numbers, and there's n of them. How many operations do you have to do to find the min in a sorted list? Yeah.
Assuming that if you're writing your code with the knowledge that your list is sorted, you can do it in, you know, just grab the first one.
It's right. Sorted. So what's okay? So finding the min, you know that it's a sorted list. Finding the min in a sorted list is big O of 1. We saw it before, it's the same as the max. You know that it's a sorted list, you have to look at only one number. So to find the first number is a 1, it takes a 1, looking at one number. Then you get rid of this guy. How long does it take to find the next min? 1, right? Again. And what about the third one? 1 again, right? And so on. How many times do we add 1? N times, right? So this is n times big O of n. So if the list is already sorted, selection sort is a big O of n algorithm. Does that help us? Well, what does selection sort do? It sorts the list, right? So the fact that it's already sorted, it doesn't matter that, you know, selection sort is so great because we don't need it, right? We just wasted big O of n operations when we didn't have to. All right, but that's kind of like the way we analyze the methods, right? So there's other methods. We're going to talk a little bit about bubble sort. And bubble sort sounds very fun. It's not as fun as it sounds like. But the idea is that the big numbers kind of bubble up to the end, and that's how it works, if you want to sort it in an ascending order. So the way it works is that you go through the list, and you check two adjacent elements. And if they're not in order, you swap them. So you start with 6 and 9. 6 is smaller than 9, they're fine. Then you go to 9 and 2. 9 and 2 are not fine. right? 9 is bigger than 2, so it needs to move, they need to swap. So you have to swap them. So then you have 9 and 5. They're not in order, you have to swap them. Then you have 9 and 8. They're not in order, you have to swap them. And then you have 9 and 4. They're not in order, you have to swap them. So after you've gone through the list one time, your biggest bubble is at the end of the list. Okay, it's like the lightest or something, because it has the most air in it. So is the list sorted now? It's not sorted. All right. But what we did is going through the list once. Our biggest element, we know that it's in the last. It's where it's supposed to be. So we do this again. 6 and 2 are not okay. 6 is bigger than 2. They need to swap. 6 and 5, it's the same thing. 6 and 8 are fine. 6 is smaller than 8, so we leave them like that. 8 and 4 need to swap to 4 and 8. And now we don't have to compare 8 and 9 because we know that 9 is the biggest element, so we don't have to worry about that. So we've gone through the list twice, and now after two times going through the list, what happens is the biggest element is in the last position, and the second biggest element is in second to last position. Is this list sorted? It's not sorted. So we do this again, and now the third to last element, the third to biggest element, is going to be in the third position to the from the right. So 6 and 4 are going to be swapped, and we don't have to go through the whole to the end of the list because we know that the biggest elements are there, are where they're supposed to be. We have to do that again. And now the list is sorted, but we don't know yet that yet. So we have to do our last step. 2 and 4 are fine. So now our list is sorted. So you can remember that the bubble sort is this kind of, the biggest elements bubble up because we always swap two adjacent elements that are not in order. All right? Does this make sense? One advantage of bubble sort over selection sort is that for selection sort, you need that additional list. You need that additional space where you're storing. Remember, you grab the smallest element, but you have to put it somewhere. It's like the sock sorting, when you needed the table to sort your socks, which is not okay because sometimes you don't have that space. This is good because it only uses, it changes things in the same list, so it only uses the space that it already has for the elements in the list. Another interesting, so what do you think bubble sort is? What kind of algorithm is it? What kind of this analysis, what would it look like for bubble sort? Well, the way the analysis would look like would be to get, when we go through the list once, right, to get the biggest element in the last position, how many elements do we have to look at?
N minus one,
right? Okay, then we know that our biggest element is in the last position. We don't have to worry about it. How many operations do we have to do to get the second to last element in the second to last position? N minus two. What is this? What kind of growth is that? What is this equal to? Wonder if you're all like, "Duh, this is the third time we're doing this today," or you're all like, "I have no idea what's going on." So, what's that? N squared, right? So if we go N squared, this is N squared over 2 minus N over 3. This is a very nice formula to remember, at least for this class. You might not use it ever again in your life, but for this class, this is gonna help a lot. It showed up a lot in quicker questions. It might show up again. You never know, but it's good to remember that. The sum of the first n numbers is n times n plus 1 over 2. Okay? So this is a big O of n squared kind of algorithm again. Now we want to improve that. We want to make it a little better. And we're going to talk about a little bit of an insight into an efficient search in a sorted list. And an analogy is the game Guess Who, where the player choose a character, and the other players have to guess using yes/no questions what the character is. And so we're gonna talk a little bit about what is a smart way of asking questions so that you minimize the number of questions you have to ask? And the analogy is also, you know, like a mind reader kind of game. So we have a whole bunch of cards, they're all different, and you guys all choose a card, let's say, and I have to guess your card. What is a good question to ask in this case? So let's say we ask the question, is the card that you're thinking about a crosshatch card? What does that do? Well, if the answer is yes, then you're left with five cards, right? So I have that's a very good situation. If the answer is no, though, it's all the rest of them, right? What is 16 minus 5? That's 11 cards are left. So that's going to be very pretty bad. If you play with kids and they kind of say that they chose their card and then they change their mind while you're playing, so that they kind of mess up the game. A kid would say, if you said, is it crosshatched, he would say no, right? So just to mess you up, because this is a kind of a bad situation, and it's going to take you longer to figure it out. So what would be a good question to ask, or kind of a good rule of thumb of how to ask questions so that even the kids who could change their mind, you have a very good number of questions, the best number of questions, the smallest number of questions possible. So, what if you ask squiggle? If it's a squiggly kind of card, if the answer is yes, no, sorry, then how many cards do you have? Well, you have 8, right? You have 8 cards out of 16. If the answer is yes, you also have 8 cards out of 16. So no matter what the other player does, even if they change their minds, that's a very good way to ask the question, because no matter what, you have equal, the sets are of equal sizes, and that's something that you want. So the second option is better because it splits it in half, and we want to choose, so the general idea is that we want to choose a question that, so that the largest of the subsets of, whether the question is yes or whether the question is no, the largest of the subset is as small as possible. So, for example, with a cross-hatched, it was splitting them into a set that was 5 cards and a set that was, this is a no, I think, or yes, and a set that was 11 cards. And the answer was no, right? Squiggle was yes, was 8 cards, and no was 8 cards. So in the worst case, you have 11 cards to work with for a crosshatch, and in the worst case you have 8 cards to work with if the question is squiggle. So you're gonna choose this one because you wanna make life as easy for you in the worst case. If nature is as bad as possible, you want to do as well as possible. How many questions? So the point is, every time you have you ask a question, so that you ask the question that splits the set in half, exactly as close as possible to half. So how many questions is that? Well, if n equals one, if you have one object, then you don't have to ask any questions. You know that that's the object. So that's a number of questions, 0. If you have two objects, you only have to ask one question, right? Is it the card on the left or is it the card on the right? And then you have your question answered. If it's 4 objects, you need 2 questions, right? Because you're saying, is it one of these cards or is it one of these cards? It's one of these cards. Was it the one on the left or is it the one on the right? So you have 2 questions. If you have 4 objects, you can guess the object with 2 questions. If n equals 8, you have 3 questions to ask, right? The first question is going to leave you with 4 objects. The second question is going to leave you with 2 objects. And the third question is going to leave you with 1 object. For n equals 16, you have 4 questions. How do you think, is there a mathematical thing that we learned about that this reminds you of? say it aloud?
2
to the power of n. So 2 to the 4 is 16. How about if I say this is the number of objects I have? How many questions do I need to ask? What's the opposite of the power, 2 to the power? Exponential function. Yeah, the log. Very good. Okay, so
it's the log.
So basically, the issue here is how many times can you have a number before you get 1? And the answer is the log of that number. Okay? So remember this, because there's going to be a question. There's a question on the exam that's going to be related to this. So, you know, you have 128. You have to guess. You have 128 options, and you want to ask as few questions as possible. How many questions do you have to ask to guess one element? Let's say that they're all distinguishable. Let's say that they're species of insects or something like that. If you ask the first question in a smart way, that's going to split the set into 64 and 64, right? Do they have wings? Yes. 64 insects, no, 64 insects. That's a very good way to ask the question. Let's say the answer was yes, you're working with 64. If you ask the question in a smart way, that's going to split the half into the answer yes is going to be 32, and the answer no is going to correspond to 32. 16, 8, 4, 2, and 1, right? So when you get to 2, you have to ask one more question. So let's count the questions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7 questions. And 2 to the 7 is actually 128, which means that log base 2 of 128 is 7. These things are the same thing. You don't have to do this whole tree. You can just figure out how many times do I need to divide 128 by 2 before I get 1 or less. So then you can just do that. Okay? Any questions about that? All right, so this is a very, very good way to ask questions. And also, we're going to see a very good way to find, if you have a sorted list already, how do you find where to insert a new element in the list? So let's say we have a sorted list, and we want to say, oh yeah, but I want to add 7 to this list. Let's say you have the phone book, and there's a new family, you know, somebody gets married or something, and they want to add their number to the phone book. What's a good way to insert that family in the phone book? And the way to do it is called binary search. And actually, you all use, I think, maybe I should say most of you probably use binary search when you look for a person in the phone book. Okay, maybe not exactly binary search, but what do you do? Well, okay, here's a method. You have the phone book, you open it in half, and you say, is this person name before the first person on the page or after? If it's before, you only work with half of the phone book and you open that in half, right? And then you do the same thing. You look at the first person there and you say, where is this person with respect to the person I'm looking for? Oh, it's to the right. Okay, I'm going to open this quarter in half, and so on. So each time you search for a person, you have the set of people they have to look at. So here's how this works. You say, okay, if we were to do it in not using that kind of method, right? How would we do it? Where we probably would have to go through the whole list and see stop basically before the number that is bigger than the number that we want to insert. So We go in the beginning, we say, okay, we have 2 is smaller than 7, we move on. 4 is smaller than 7, we move on. 5, 6 are smaller than 7, we move on. When we run into 8, we stop, and we know that 7 needs to be inserted there. So we know that 7 needs to be inserted right before the element where we stop. So what's the maximum number of comparisons in this case? How many numbers do we have to look at in the worst case? I heard the answer. It's just not loud enough. N. Right? Because in the worst case, the element that we need to insert is the last element in the list. So a better way to do it is, let's look in the middle of the list. And let's see if the number that we want to insert is bigger or smaller. So this makes us jump in the middle from the beginning. If there's a million numbers, we just go to the middle. And basically say, okay, 7 is bigger than 5, so I'm going to forget about the whole half of the list to the left. I'm not even going to look at them. I'm just going to focus on, 7 is definitely inserted between 5 and 9. So if the number that I want to insert is smaller than the number in the middle, I'm going to go to the left. If the number that I want to insert is bigger than the number in the middle, I'm going to go to the right. So basically, now I'm only working with half of the list. I go to the half again. The half is 6, let's say. And I know that 7 is bigger than 6, so I'm going to only look in the quarter of a list. 8 is the middle. And so now I know that 7 needs to come between 6 and 8. So it's right there. I found it. And now I can insert it, and the list is sorted. And that's log of n plus 1, basically. That's a log n kind of algorithm. We haven't had any of these so far, but this is an example if you were wondering. I'm sure you were. What's some kind of log n kind of algorithm? That this is one of them, right? And this is what you do with a phone book, too. You have, whenever you search for somebody, you have the set of people into you. Ask yes-no questions like this. Is he or she before the half or not? And then you just work with half the list the whole time. So each problem like this that always has the set of possibilities in half is a log n kind of thing. So now, how can we make a search? How can we make a sorting algorithms using this insight? Because this is good. Log n is a very small number. We like that. Maybe we can improve our sorting. So binary search sort just says, okay, let's assume that I'm working with a sorted list, and every time I'm taking a number, I just insert it in a sorted list. So I start with no numbers. The first number I take is, a sorted list. One number is a sorted list. I take the second number, and I insert it in a sorted list. I take the third number, and I insert it in a sorted list. It's going to stay sorted like that the whole time. And because inserting a number in a sorted list is a log n kind of problem, we're going to get n log n instead of n squared, which is much better. N log n is a smaller number of operations than n squared. So this is kind of the code for it, if you want to take a look at it. For this one, 100 items get sorted in a half of a minute, which is 5 times less than selection sort. So that n squared there's a big difference between the n log n and the n squared, even if n is just 100. All right, this is the last sorting algorithms we're gonna talk about today. It's called quicksort. And the reason why it's called quicksort is because in practice, it works the fastest of all the So if you were to actually write a computer program that would implement quicksort, that would probably beat all the other sorting algorithms. So the idea is that if you could always choose or know the median, let's say there you have a little, fairy who knows exactly what the median of every list is at any point in time. And she can answer in constant time. She doesn't have to think too much about it. So let's say she can tell you what the median is. If you know the median, then what you can do is you can say, okay, the median is in the middle of the sorted list, and I can just take every element in the list. If it's smaller than the medium, I'm going to put it to the left. If it's bigger than the medium, I'm going to put it to the right. Maybe I should do it at the opposite because you guys see the opposite. So the smallest numbers are going to be in the front of the list. The biggest numbers are going to be to the back of the list. And then what I can do is I can just sort the same way, the list to the left and the list to the right. And so, for example, if my list is this list, and I know the median, let's say I know that the median is 56, then I can split the set into the smaller numbers in the median, the bigger number, the numbers that are bigger than the median, and then I'm sorting this list, which is going to give me this, and I'm sorting the bigger list, which is going to give me that, and then I just glue them together. So I know that I'm putting this list, then the median, 56, then this list, and that's going to give me the sorted list. Okay, so the problem is we can't find the median. Finding the median is a very costly process. And so what Quicksort says is just choose a random element in the list and pretend that it's the median. And what you're going to do is you choose your element, and then the smaller numbers, you're going to put them to the left, the bigger numbers, you're going to put them to the right, and then you're going to sort the left and the right elements. So the idea is that on average, 25% of the time, your number is going to be in the first quarter of the list. 50% of the time, though, it's going to be between the first quarter, so it's going to be in the middle half of the list, which is still close to the median, and that's what makes it run so fast. So you have this pretty good chance of getting a number that's close-ish to the median. So let's see how that works. The way it works is you always pick the item, any item in the list, you call it the pivot, and you just go through the whole list and you put the elements that are smaller than the pivot to the left, the elements that are bigger than the pivot to the right, and then you just sort the other halves recursively. You're going to do the same thing. You're going to choose a pivot, smaller to the left, bigger to the right, and so on. So how would it work on the list that we've been working on? Well, first of all, you're going to pick a random item. And let's say your item is 5. So what you're going to do now, you're going to put the elements that are smaller than 5 to the left and the elements that are bigger than 5 to the right. So which elements are smaller than 5 in that list?
Two and four.
Okay? So this is what's going to happen. You're going to have all the elements that are smaller to the left, all the elements that are bigger to the right. The elements are smaller, so 4 and 2 are not sorted. The two lists are not sorted, but we're going to worry about that later. And so if we were to sort the list, the unsorted list, this is what we're going to get. We're going to get a sorted list. Okay? But right now we don't have the sorted. The two lists are unsorted yet. So we're going to do the same thing for the list to the left. We're going to choose a random element. Let's say it's 2. We're going to put everything that's smaller than 2 to the left of 2. There's nothing like that. Everything that's bigger than 2 to the right, which is 4. And then we're done because we're finished sorting the list. The other list, let's pick eight, pick randomly 8. And then 6 is smaller, 9 is bigger. We're sorting the two halves, but those are one number list, so those are sorted. So we're done. So that's how quicksort works. It'll be easier to see it on a bigger list, but that will take way too long. So we're not going to play this. I'm going to send you a link. The four algorithms we talked about are selection sort and bubble sort, which are big O of n squared, where n is how many elements are in the list. Binary search sort and quicksort are n log n. And just to give you an idea, if you have 1 million elements in the list, which is like an average size list, then n squared is like 1 with 12 zeros. It's a big number. N log n is 7 million operations. So you get a difference between 10 to the 12 and 7 million, which is a pretty big difference. Which means that we like something, we are going to like the n log n algorithms over the n squared algorithms. So, again, what we saw that is that the way web search works is it gathers all the pages using this graph structure of the internet, So that's how it uses graphs. And then it indexes the words using sorting. So it takes all the words in the web page, it sorts them, and then it can find quickly what's the order. It can find the words quicker. It can add the web page to the list of the web pages that contain that word, and so on. So in one of the next future lectures, we're going to see how they can. Another element to Google and web search is that they use a lot of computers that work together at the same time, so in parallel. And we're going to see that, and that's also something that they use. This is kind of the last part of the algorithm and heuristics idea. Heuristics are kind of, they're included here because sometimes your problems are so hard, your algorithms take so long, that you need some kind of rule of thumb to solve them. So algorithms, the difference between algorithms and heuristics is that algorithms are always work. They're fail-safe, they are guaranteed to do their job. There's a whole branch in computer science that figures out that they're correct and that they're always going to finish, and that it's the, you know, there's a very rigorous mathematical background. Heuristics are more like, oh yeah, I noticed that this thing works in 96% of the time, and I'm happy with that. It doesn't matter if it fails 3% of the time or 4% of the time. I'm going to work with it because it's fast, and it kind of gives me something that's very close to what I want. So we call heuristics algorithms too, which is not really okay, but sometimes that's the only thing that we can work with. And an example of a heuristic is. The hardest problem that I think we talked about in this class, that's my judgment, is you're given a list, and you have to answer the question: is there any subset of elements in this list that sum up to a certain number? And we saw that problem is if you were to test all the subsets, all the possible subsets, that's a 2n kind of algorithm. It's an exponential algorithm, and we don't like exponential algorithms. They're way too slow. For any decent size input, most computers crash, so we don't want that. Let's say we're happy if we just get close. We don't really want exactly 433, we just want something that's close to 433. So how can we do that? We can use something that's called hill climbing. And the way hill climbing works is it just chooses randomly a set of random numbers. Let's say 41, 46, 2, 27, which sum up to 368. And the question is, okay, what numbers can we add to this list to make it as close as possible to 431? Okay, and that's just like looking at maybe all the elements in the list. Or you can also choose, if you have a lot of elements, you can just choose randomly numbers, and you can just say, this is as close as I can get to 430. So, for example, if you add 63 to that subset, you get to 431, and you might be happy with that. It's not the ideal solution, but it's pretty close. And, as a lot of heuristics, hill climbing has limitations. You can get stuck into, local maxima. It's not guaranteed that you're going to find something that's good. If you start with a bad initial subset, you might really get stuck in a bad place. But most of the time, it gives pretty satisfactory solutions. Okay, and so we're going to come back. We actually started talking about the whole philosophical part of computer science, a little bit of, it's not such a rigorous, you have this algorithm. But I would like to talk about this a little more because there's a very interesting problem and very interesting philosophical concepts that I would like to touch on and that, we actually wanted to. So we talked about this. We said that what does it mean to have, power? What does it mean for a device to be more powerful than a different device? And the reason why this problem comes up is because people worry as devices get more powerful and more powerful, people worry that the computers will take over the world. And so we would like to know, are there limitations to computers? And, you know, Hollywood, like, there's a lot of movies with, you know, The Matrix and so on, where artificial intelligence is so powerful and they're so smart that they, you know, outsmart humans and they're going to take over. And just to clarify, we're not even close to that. We are very, very far away from that. But it's still good to talk about power. And what does it mean for a device to be more powerful than another device? And so we said that we can say that a device is more powerful than another device if the, let's say device number one, device number two. Device number two is more powerful than device number one. If anything that device one can do, device two can also do. And so the arrows in the pictures show, the arrow means can simulate, right? So the Dell can simulate, a PC can simulate a Mac can simulate a PC. That means that they're equally powerful. So another interesting concept is this concept of a Turing machine. And this is Alan Turing, was a very smart guy. He lived around the 1930s was when he did most of his work. And that was before computers. And he came up, he was asking the question, can you make a computer or a machine that can think like a person? And he came up with this mathematical model of he called it a universal machine. Because, you know, computers back then meant a person who can carry out computations. So he came up with this notion of a Turing machine. And that notion is almost like you can imagine a mathematician, a very, very smart mathematician that can solve any problem in the world that can be solved. And he also has a tape that he can write on that's infinite. It never ends. So this is an idealized model. Alan Turing showed that any calculation that the smart mathematician can do can also be performed by just a clerk that just follows a very simple set of instructions. So any problem, any mathematical problem, no matter how hard it is, can be solved by just following a whole bunch of steps if you're very meticulous and you don't make mistakes. And again, you know, this is assuming that you have an infinite amount of time, that you have an infinite scroll that's infinitely long. And he further showed that actually you only need a state machine. You only need a state machine, and what that state machine can do, the only thing that it can do is either write on this tape a symbol or read from the tape. So that's, you know, all the machine can do is either write a symbol on the tape or read a symbol from the tape. So, which, you know, to summarize, this says that anything that a super smart mathematician can do, a very hard problem, can be made by a stupid machine that can just go and read and write, and that's it. That's all they can do. And so this is actually the theoretical model of a computer. And he called it a universal machine, which I thought was gonna kind of cool. And there is no known device in the known world that is more powerful than a Turing machine. Anything in the world, any computer, the most complex computers in the world, can be reduced. Anything that a computer can do, any computer can do, a Turing machine can do too. Which is amazing because the Turing machine is such a simple device. So there are also people have come up with a whole bunch of models of computation. I'm just gonna talk very briefly about them. The von Neumann architecture is the one that we talked about with the input. This is a computer that we know, right? We have the memory, we have the processor. The processor kind of carries out the operations, and it stores them in memory. It can show them on the screen. You input stuff on the keyboard. That's the von Neumann architecture. Then you have the Turing machine, which is just a finite state machine and a very long tape. There's also stuff that is called post correspondence, which is just a bunch of strings. So you do computation using just strings. There's lambda calculus. You might have heard of it, which is everything is reduced to mathematical functions. So anything in the world is a mathematical function. There's also the Chomsky context-sensitive grammars. And then there's programming languages. So there's all these different paradigms of computation. So we know that the Phylum and architecture can simulate programming languages because we run programming languages on our computers, right? We also know that we can simulate a computer using programming languages. So this is the example of you have a Mac that can simulate a PC. There's a software that somebody wrote that runs on the Mac that can simulate a computer. Then you have all these can simulate arrows, and it turns out that they're all equivalent, that they all, whatever one can do, whatever you compute in one of them, can be computed in the other ones. So we're not missing out. If we learn one of them, we're not missing out on any kind of computation that is going on in the world. All right, so those are all the arrows. This is, I think we talked about this too. And so we can go back to randomness, because I would like to talk about how randomness is used in practical applications. So let's try to do this problem. This is a random question, I can say that. So the question is, what values can V take? And V is equal to 5 plus random 1, 2, 3 times 9. And the options are A, 14, 15, 16, B, 14, 32, C, 14, 23, or 32, D, 5, 14, 23, or 32, and E, 5, or 23. I'll stop at 1:30. Five more seconds. Stopping. Okay, good. All right. So pick random 1 to 3 says pick a random number between 1, 2, or 3. Okay, so if it picks 1, it's going to be 5 plus 1 times 9. That's 5 plus 9, that's 14. If it's 2, it's 5 plus 2 times 9, 2 times 9, which is 5 plus 18, which is 23. And if it's 3, it's 3 times 9 is 27 plus 5, 32. What about this one? What values can V take? And this time V is equal to 6 plus random 0 to 1 times 10. A, 616, B, 610, C, 010, D, any value between 6 and 16, E, 6 or 70. Stopping in 10. Stopping. Okay, good. All right. So we said before that we can make, because all the numbers, all the information the computer is represented by bits, we can make random numbers by just making random bits and then putting and then, you know, basically converting between binary and decimal if we wanted to. And so computers can be totally random, right? Because the computer says what's going in, you know exactly what's going in, you know exactly how the thing is computed, and you know exactly what's coming out. But the thing is that most of physics is not completely random. I'm not going to do this. So a very interesting concept is the concept of random effects. And you're going to see that why I'm bringing this up. So pseudo-random, so the idea is that any encryption, by encryption I mean, okay, when you have a bank account and you can log into your bank and you can see how much money you have, you can transfer money between accounts. You have a username and a password, right? And so the username and the password, your password is, the bank website uses that password to kind of, that information is available only to you, right? And if it was broken into, that would not be good because people could steal your money. So the question is how, if we wanted to simulate randomness, if we wanted to make computers to be random, we can use quantum mechanics. And what the idea of quantum mechanics is, just to get started and to say, the main thing is that if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you probably don't understand it. So if this is going to make, if this is going to be weird, it's weird to me too. And I don't say that I understand it, but there's a very cool application to it. And so I just want to introduce it to you guys, and don't worry if you get lost at some point, because I'm just as lost too. So here's how you can see this. Imagine that there's a box, and in that box there's a cat. And what can happen is that there can be, there's a hammer, and the hammer can fall on a bag of poison, and it can kill the cat, if that's the case. The hammer falling is a random effect that you can't control and you don't know. If you don't know if that's happened or not. No animals were killed in this experiment. This is a theoretical thing. Alright, and you know, you can replace the cat with some animal you don't like. Alright, I like cats a lot, but this was the experiment that started. Alright, so you have this box, right? Imagine you have this box and there's a cat, and the cat, you don't know if the cat is dead or alive at any point. So from your perspective, the cat can be both dead and alive at the same time. I mean, it's just this, the box is a state that encodes two things at the same time. The thing, this is exactly something that summarizes quantum effect. So if I were to open the box, I would know exactly if the cat was still alive or dead. So if I measure anything that's quantum, that kills the quantum state of it. It can't be, now I know exactly what it is. So measuring something that's a quantum effect kills the quantumness of it. Okay, so that's how I understand it. Now if we move to bits, we can say that, let's say that we have quantum bits. And we have this number that's n bits, but we don't know what the bits are, right? Because if we measure it, it's not quantum anymore. So we have, let's say we have n boxes, and in each box there can be a 0 or 1, but we don't know what it is. So from our perspective, that number, that n quantum bit number, encodes 2 to the n possibilities. You can make 2 to the n numbers with n bits. And so, it's almost like you're encoding 2 to the n possibilities at the same time, which is really cool. Again, if you look in the boxes and measure the number, or measure the bits, or look at the bits, you know exactly what they are, so they're not quantum anymore. But the thing is, the problem is that somehow quantum, if you can come up with a quantum algorithm or quantum effects, that would mean that factoring would be easy. Factoring is the mathematical theory that stands at the basis of encryption. So the reason why your passwords work, and the reasons why secrets work, and by secrets I mean, you know, that those kinds of secrets. So passwords or, you know, locks and all kinds of things like that that are very safe, it's because there are too many possibilities to try out to find somebody's password, basically. So it's based on factoring large numbers, which is a very, very hard problem. It would take, you know, it would take too many years. It would take, let's say, 25 years for somebody to break a password. That means that it's not worth doing it because, you know, maybe 20 years I'll be dead, right? If I can get, like, you know, a few thousand dollars in 25 years, I'm not really interested in doing that. I want, you know, a few, you know, thousand dollars now. But the thing is, if they figure out how to use a quantum computer and make quantum algorithms, that would break any password in the world. And so now they have to. There's research going on that is looking at making quantum computers, and I think they got to a 6 or 7 bit computer, so they can already work with 6 or 7 bits. And so right now, what they need to do, is to figure out how to make an encryption, a new password system that would be safe to quantum computers. Otherwise, things wouldn't work very well. This is just a slide that people have come up with. Okay, what is the counter? How can we strike back, right? So we have quantum computers that can break our passwords. How can we make some kind of algorithm that would work so that passwords cannot be broken? So I can see that somebody has been looking at it. And it's all based on the fact that if somebody sneaks at my secret, if somebody looks at something that's quantum, that destroys the quantum essence of it, and so I'm going to be able to figure out that somebody's actually seen it. Somebody's peeked in my password or account or whatever. All right, so that was about quantum. I'm not going to go into this. Is like physics, and I don't want to go into that. But another interesting idea is the idea of, don't listen to anything I say between now and when the class finishes. Yeah. I guess cool or not cool, I don't know what to say. But I just want to talk about this idea of self-contradiction. We're going to start it today, and we're going to finish it next time. The idea is that interesting things happen when something can refer to itself. And this is going back to recursion, right? When you have subroutines that can call themselves, and that you can, like the subroutine that was drawing a tree, right? It was saying a tree is a line and then two more trees to the left and to the right. So one interesting idea in this family is the idea of oxymorons, which is a statement. So it's a construction where the two words put together look like they don't fit together. Looks like they contradict each other. And there's actually a website called which is oxymoronlist.com. And people go there and they, chat and they make up oxymorons. It's pretty fun. But this is the top 10 oxymorons on that list. So, government organization, alone together, right? Personal computer, silent scream, living dead, same difference, tape live, plastic glasses, tight slacks, peace force, pretty ugly, authentic reproduction, working vacation, tax return, virtual reality, Dodge Ram, work party, jumbo shrimp, healthy tan, and Microsoft Works. I have a Microsoft computer, but I thought that was still fun. But what you notice that even though the two words look like they contradict each other, there's two words that you take their literal meanings and you put them together and they contradict each other. So for example, jumbo shrimp doesn't mean that it's huge and it's also very small. It just means that it's, for a shrimp, it's pretty big for a shrimp, right? So they all kind of make sense. So the contradiction isn't very deep. Other examples there's all kinds of examples around us. But, when you say stuff like, I can't talk right now, and, you're talking, I'm sorry, but I just don't care. You're either sorry or you don't care. I prefer not to have an opinion. I'm speechless. I'm not in denial. But I don't speak English. In English. I can't talk right now, I said. Don't let me pressure you, and so on. Leave me be, I'm asleep. These are also kind of funny ones that you guys can read. Oh, my favorite one, I think, is the second to last one. It says, last month I blew $5,000 on a reincarnation seminar. I figured, hey, you only live once. So that was pretty funny. All right. So they all laugh when I said I was going to be a comedian. Well, they're not laughing now. He's a comedian, so there's a problem that they're not laughing. All right. Okay. So I think I'm going to close with this. These are all kinds of contradiction that we see all around us. So there's, I don't know, there's stuff like you see on the page, they leave blank spaces and then they write this space that is intentionally left blank, but they wrote something on it, so it's not blank anymore. There's stuff like this, apparently, somewhere. It says no name, which is actually the name of the exit. I wonder how the directions sound. And then you take the exit, no name. I guess you can say the number. You know, there's the start before using. Keep this door closed at all times. I see that a lot. This is a computer science kind of idea. So when you program in C or Java, you can put comments in your code so that people would understand what you did. And you put them between a slash, star, star, slash. But this says no comment as a comment, and so on. All right. Thanks for staying, and we're going to continue next time.